Right. Well, thank you. And I have to say that's a really tough act to follow. So I'm not going to be anywhere near as funny as Tim. I'm not going to have anywhere near as interesting a slides as Tim. I'm afraid I'm going to be much more dry. What Tim and Joe in particular have covered is where the economy is at the moment and the medium, the sort of the short-term outlook for the economy. So Joe talked about the headwinds that the economy is seeing and what that might mean for growth and inflation and so on. I'm going to take a different lens. My job is to worry. That's what I do. I worry. And so my lens is to look at what could go wrong, what really could go badly wrong. And the lens I'm going to take here is financial stability. Now, financial stability is sort of a difficult thing to describe. I think it's actually easier to think of the flip side, which is what is financial instability. And everyone remembers the global financial crisis. That was an episode where financial instability basically brought the economy around the world, pretty much, not Australia, but the North Atlantic, brought it really, really heavily to its knees. If you have financial instability, that is in your banking system, in your financial sector, it can have very, very big impacts on the real economy, and that means very real impacts on people, you and me. And you saw that overseas in the global financial crisis, you saw unemployment rates shoot up, you saw lots and lots of problems in many of the European countries. So this is a big issue. So I'm going to talk through that lens about what might be some possible risks and threats to financial stability in Australia. And I'm going to look, there's quite a few. I worry a lot, so there's plenty of things I could talk about. But I'm going to concentrate on three today. The first is on what's happening in financial markets. And as possibly some of you are trustees or maybe work on investment committees, hopefully this might give you a little bit of food for thought about what's going on in financial markets and the fact that there seems to be no compensation for risk at the moment in financial markets. And I'll tell you why I worry about that in a minute. The second issue I'm going to talk a little bit about is corporate debt. As some of you may remember, the whole global financial crisis really started from massive amounts of mortgage debt in the United States, and it turned out a lot of those people couldn't pay it back. And that sort of was the initial impetus for the global financial crisis, which ended up blowing back onto the banks, and hence the whole thing came down. And the final thing I want to talk about is Australian household stress and household debt. And Joe referred to this a little bit because this is quite important in terms of the way people think about their well-being. So the first thing I wanted to talk about, as I said, is no compensation for risk. Now, this graph here shows you 10-year government bond yields. On the right-hand panel, you've got the UK, Germany and Japan. The left-hand panel, you've got United States 10-year government bond yields. And then there's another one line below it called the US term premium. Now, the term premium is compensation for basically holding something for 10 years when the outcome is uncertain. And typically, the term premium for 10-year bonds is positive because you don't know what's going to happen to inflation in the future. You might think it's not going to go up by very much, but you want a little bit of compensation for the possibility that it might. So two things to take away from this chart. The first is that government bond yields are historically really low levels. They're negative in some countries. Some of you might realise that in holding a bond to maturity, you are actually paying. You don't get any compensation for that. The US term premium, what it's telling you, is that people are taking no compensation for a 10-year horizon. They basically think that inflation's going nowhere, interest rates are going to be pretty much where they are in 10 years' time. Now, the Governor's also pointed out that it's not surprising in some sense that interest rates have come down because it partly reflects a savings investment demand supply, if you like. So there's lots of savings and there's not so much investment, so you expect interest rates to come down. But it's also and it's also true that certainly some, including Australia, but other central banks are lowering interest rates. The economic outlook and the outlook for inflation isn't very high. So you might say that's fine, but this is still very unusual. And as risk-free rates are coming down, people are searching for yield. They're looking for other things to invest in. And that's pushing up asset prices in all sorts of other places. You know that at the moment, notwithstanding the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty about the global economy and a lot of uncertainty about economies generally, corporate bond spreads are actually at historically low levels. That's saying that there's no compensation for the risk that some of these corporates, in fact, might be impacted by a global economy downturn. So what does this all mean? Why might this be a worry? Well, the reason it might be a worry is if things snap back, if, for example, inflation reasserts itself, so you see the traditional relationship between unemployment and inflation reassert itself, you might see a snap back in these risk-free rates. If that happens, you might see asset prices fall in other places. And if that happens and people are indebted and they've got lots of leverage, you've potentially got issues for the financial system. It might be that the economies around the world, in fact, continue to not perform very well and trade tensions worsen and all those sorts of things, in which case you'd have to wonder about the financial viability of some of the corporates. So this is all just by saying that you've got these really low rates of interest, you've got these really low risk premia, and you've got an uncertain world, and something just doesn't seem right about that. So the worry for me is that if it snaps back, it'll catch a lot of people napping. I mentioned corporate debt, which is the second thing I wanted to briefly talk about. Corporate debt has been rising in a number of countries overseas, particularly Canada, France, and the United States. And some parts of the US corporate debt market, there's been a very large increase in leveraged loans in the United States. So these are loans that are, they're loans to companies that perhaps aren't great credit risks. They're not as far up the asset quality spectrum as others. That's been rising quite quickly, so some people are worrying a bit about that. I think the country that we've worried most about in the last little while has been China. Now, China, what you've seen from this graph on the left-hand side, you can see that the total debt of the non-financial sector in China is around about 260%, 265%. It's much higher than any other country at a similar stage of development. And the rate at which it rose through that period, through 2007 up until about 2016, the rate at which that rose and the rate at which corporate debt in particular rose suggests to you that some of the credit quality here was not real good. There's some state-owned enterprises that perhaps have been investing here unwisely. That might mean that there is potential problems coming down the track here. You'll notice it has turned down, and that's been partly as a result of the efforts of the Chinese government to try and cap this growth in debt. Because you can see from the right-hand side of the panel that it's been driven, the blue sort of bit at the bottom, that's the non-bank financial sector. That's the non-bank sector that has been driving a lot of this growth, and some of the smaller banks are very exposed to this non-bank financial sector. It's not transparent, it's not well regulated, and the concern is that there's been a lot of investment in companies and perhaps state-owned enterprises that they're going to find difficult paying these things back. So this is the issue, and the worry for Australia is that if China has a financial crisis, that will blow back not so much to us in direct sense financially, but it will blow back through the economy and then ultimately possibly onto the financial sector. Now, on Australian household debt, Joe already highlighted that we do have very high household debt in Australia. It's around about 190% of... what I wanted to make the point here, though, was that although the level of debt is quite high in Australia, its distribution is actually quite quite positive in terms of risk here. So if you look on the left-hand panel, you'll see that these are along the bottom, these are income quintiles. So one is the bottom 20% of income earners, two is the next 20%, etc. What you'll see here is that three quarters of the debt is actually owned by households that sit in the top 40% of the income distribution. So that's actually a positive thing. So if you just look at the total, debt, it looks quite high. But if you look at the distribution, that suggests to you that actually maybe it's okay, because people in the higher income distributions, they actually have the capacity possibly to meet their payments. They're less likely to become unemployed. You'll see the similar thing in the right-hand panel, which is the median debt-to-income ratio. You'll see that the dots show you where it was in 2003-2004, and the bars are the more recent period. You'll see that it's risen across all of the income quintiles, but again, the higher debt-to-income ratio sit with the households that have higher income. So that's a positive thing. Another signal, perhaps, that might be a signal of stress is housing loan arrears. And the left-hand panel here shows you the rest of Australia, aside from Queensland, WA and the NT. The thing I want you to take away from this is that housing loan arrears have been rising. They're still pretty low in absolute levels, but they're actually rising mainly because of West Australia, Northern Territory and Queensland. And those are the economies that have been most badly affected by the wind back of the mining investment boom. And those economies have been quite badly affected. They've seen rises in unemployment. They have seen, population decreases in some cases. So although arrears are rising, it's actually reasonably concentrated in a couple of states. And the bank's exposure to those couple of states is actually reasonably contained. So this I think, also is positive for the banking sector. And the final thing I wanted to talk about with respect to household stress is something that people worry about with the fall in housing prices, and that's loans in negative equity. So the left-hand bar shows you the share of loans in negative equity, the share of total balances in all of Australia, and it's around about 3.5%. Now, negative equity in itself is not necessarily a problem, because provided you've got a job and you're continuing to pay your loan off, it's not a big deal if you're living in your house. Where it becomes more of a problem is if you lose your job, you need to sell your house in order to meet your debt repayments, and your house isn't worth as much as your debt. That's when it starts to be a problem. So we can see it's actually not a huge problem in Australia as a whole. If you look at the right-hand panel by state, and you'll notice that the vertical axis is different here, you'll see that in WA and the Northern Territory, around about 20% of loans are in negative equity. So their houses are worth less than their debt. And given that those states also are experiencing problems with unemployment, this might be a concern, because it might make it more difficult for people to get themselves out of the debt trap. So on the one hand, there are pockets of stress in the Australian household sector at the moment. But broadly, I think, although we think we want to monitor, we're still continuing to monitor it, broadly, it seems that the pockets of stress are relatively contained, and that there's reason to think that the people that hold the debt actually have the ability to service it. So to wrap up, I guess what I'd like you to take away from this is that, yes, we've got an economy at the moment that is slowing. There are some things to be slightly concerned about, and we'll continue to monitor them. If you're thinking with your investment hats on, I think you should be thinking about what are some of the worst-case scenarios that might happen, and that's the sort of thing I'm talking about here. It's worst-case scenarios. Because I think if we all become complacent in a world that it's growing, and it's not growing too fast, and it's not growing too slow, but it's muddling along, we might become a little bit complacent in our investment choices. So I would challenge you just to think a little bit outside the box, and think about whether or not there might be some issues in thinking about investments that you should be considering going forward. Thank you.
pop over the comfy chairs.
Wonderful. We're just going to pop over the comfy chairs so we can get some Q&A going. Michelle, thank you very much for your presentation. And I'm going to have my first question to Michelle about bonds. And I think there's certainly some interesting analysis there on risk premium. But are negative bond yields sustainable in the medium term?
Well, that's an interesting question. They're not, and that's what worries us. But in an environment at the moment where you have a slowing growth, you have governments. Let me go back a step. Yep. The point I made at the beginning, which was that interest rates are the price that clears the supply and demand. So it's investment and savings. At the moment, I think Joe highlighted this, investment actually is not doing very well, and it's not doing very well because everyone's uncertain, they don't want to invest. So while ever we've got this situation, I think that the downward pressure on bond yields is going to remain. Is it normal to have bond yields basically giving, you're paying effectively to carry the bond? There's certainly lots of institutional investors who are prepared to carry them, but in the long run, you would hope that you would have an economic environment where that wouldn't be necessary, that you'd have an environment of growing a stronger investment, which would mean that interest rates would be rising, inflation would be rising, and bonds would not be negative anymore. I mean, if we're in this world, then this is a very sad world we're in.
It's quite interesting in the last... this year, in 2019, has been the rapid rise in private sector negative yielding bonds. And that, I think, is a concern, right? Like, that one is actually even harder to get...
It's astonishing, isn't it?
It's astonishing. Really? It's harder to get your mind around why an investor would hold that over a sovereign negative
yielding bond. Well, they're getting nothing for credit risk at all.
Yeah.
Negative, they're paying for to hold credit risk, which seems bizarre.
One of the themes all three of you touched upon was China and the role of China. So this is probably to all... I might start with you, Tim. It used to be, the adage used to be, I think it was the US, if they sneeze, we catch a cold. Is it a case if China gets a cold, we get the flu? Are we dependent on China for our ongoing success?
Yeah, well, both Joe and Michelle touched on this. I mean, this great transformation, you know, this nation of shippers, export, led growth and so on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this complete shift to say we've got to be a nation of shoppers, domestic consumption, domestic investment. I think in some ways that plays quite well for Australia, given our exports of coal and iron ore, given our exports of agriculture. I mean, Australia can't feed China, but it can help China build up its agricultural capacity. And increasingly now in professional services. So I actually think this great transformation China's undertaking is good for Australia. The main risk, I think, with these trade wars is, of course, as a small open economy, no one wins, you know, for trade wars, particularly us. And you actually do not want China and America getting on too well. The worst thing would be, a terrible...
Sorry, you don't want them getting on too well?
No, you don't.
In what way?
Because they'd have managed trade and they could basically cut out our agricultural exporters. Yeah. So in some ways, you want a bit of sort of tension between China and America that's contained and doesn't spread. If Donald Trump and Xi did a managed trade deal and cut everyone else out, other countries would be encouraged to do the same. We don't want that.
Okay. Joe, what are your thoughts?
Sure, I mean, China's a big topic. I tend to be China positive. There's obviously some risks, and I think, as Michelle noted, some of that leverage in the system, and particularly in the shadow banking system, is a concern. But broadly, I feel like we've been talking about China faltering since I started work, and China seems to actually do quite a good job.
Since 1949, I think we've been talking about it.
Oh, well, that's long before I started work.
Even before I started work.
So I think when we look forward, there's a cyclical element, and certainly if growth in China falls dramatically, our resource base is going to be quite challenged, although we do know that China uses steel-intensive construction to stimulate its economy. I think the most important point, which sort of aligns with Tim's, though, is that there is the structural rise of the middle class in China. and it is growing rapidly in number and in average disposable income. And we are incredibly well placed to feed into that. Now, we already see that in education and tourism. Together, they are as big an export as coal now. But it's more than that. And under the signing of the free trade agreement with China, under CHAFTA, it is things like healthcare, professional services, engineering services, architectural services, agricultural services, IP. And I actually think it's very exciting.
I think Jo's right. And I mean, when you go to those, big country little country towns of 33 million, Chengdu and Chongqing and Wuhan and so on. I mean, you now meet Australian exporters who have set up there. So you get Australian architects who don't want to necessarily do Shanghai or Beijing, where the international competition is. They set up, in Chengdu, and they get all the shopping malls and all the civic buildings for Western China. You get a South Australian wine company, Shearers Hill, in Fleurieu Peninsula. They've actually made Qingdao their base, because they know in Shanghai with the upper middle class you've got to compete with France and everyone else. So they said, we're going to make wine just for Qingdao, just in that province. Right. And that's been, it's almost like we've been able to do little mini episodes of all these second and third tier cities in China that are very significant cities. And that's where the optimism comes from. The caution is not just what Michelle said, but China's having troubles with its political institutions. It's Hong Kong, it surprised it. China was used to being someone who got foreign investment. Now it's itself been an outward investor, and they're now starting to realise all these things about intellectual property that everyone else screamed about, they've got to deal with too. And in some ways, President Trump's taking on China on IP and on subsidies and so on, I think a lot of people are quite happy he is. And I think they're letting him do a lot of the hard work for us. I think the EU and I think Brazil and Japan and Korea, I think they're quite happy for Donald Trump to take on China.
Michelle, I'm conscious about one of your statements that made me feel better about the world was about household debt. And I think there has been a sort of national obsession about the high level of household debt on average. But what I'm hearing is distributionally, the RBA is comfortable with it because it's focused on high-income earners. Is that the right takeaway for us in the audience?
I think that is the right takeaway. There's a lot of focus on the headline figure, but the distribution is important. And as I highlighted in that graph, 3/4 of the debt is held by people in the top 40% of income. And that's positive. It means, and the other thing we know about households as well is that they are actually making quite a lot of prepayments on their loans. To Joe's point about the tax income, the recent reductions in interest rates as well, there are signs that people aren't actually using that to go out and spend. They're actually using it to pay off their debt. Now, in one sense, that's not helpful for the economy, but it's helpful for stability because it just brings closer the day at which they feel more comfortable with their level of debt, and then they can go out and spend. So it doesn't help right now, but it's good for stability, and it's good for the household balance sheet. And I think signs at the moment are that people are just being a little more cautious.
This is the OK Boomer effect in households. Right. They're paying off their debt, all the property they've stolen off the future generations, they're paying it off. So Michelle's invented the OK Boomer effect right here today.
You've made the call, Tim.
It is. There it
now,
is.
This is a question to all three of you. It looks like Donald Trump may well the 2020 election, presidential election. I suppose it depends what happens with Bloomberg and Biden, etc. But are there any implications for a second-term Trump government in terms of trade? Is there anything we need to be conscious of? And I'm conscious we touched upon that relationship between China and the US, but is there anything Australia in particular needs to be conscious of that?
Well, it's a long time to the election next year, and it's really determined by, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, these Midwest states that Hillary Clinton didn't campaign there after the convention. I think Bill told her to, and she said, oh, no, we've done the numbers, they're fine. And Trump was able to win them. It's a question of whether will he retain them? Because there are people, selling soya beans from Iowa and manufacturing exporters from Wisconsin who are probably hurting from this trade war now. But there is a view that, hey, someone is taking on China, and it might be hurting me, but someone had to do it because China is rising, and it's more a geopolitical thing that America's got to
stand up to them. So I think, despite their economic interests, he might actually do quite well. But there's a long way to go. I mean, I was surprised he went after Biden in a way through the Ukrainians, because in some ways Biden might have been an easy opponent than some of the others, even with potential ones coming in. Yeah, but I think if he gets in, I think he'll be completely he'll feel completely vindicated from his trade policy approach. I mean, I, like many a trade economist, thought he would just, you know, twitter a bit here and there and get a couple of plants to stay in Wisconsin and not go to Mexico and just declare victory. The tariffs, he really surprised a lot of us.
I think Joe, this one, I've got slightly different question. Sure. Brexit. Yeah. What does that mean for Australia?
Yeah, I mean, who knows what Brexit even is anymore, right? I mean, it's moving so rapidly. If you look from a direct perspective, we actually don't trade that much directly with the UK anymore. So in that sense, I'm not that concerned about sort of a hard exit or the like. It does, though, play into sentiment, and that sentiment is playing into not just investment plans, but increasingly hiring intentions, and that worries me. So it's just one more layer that is seeing firms feel uncertain about their outlook. And the reason that hiring intentions are so important is actually, to come back to Michelle's point, that if I'm holding a whole lot of debt, even if I'm in the top 40% of income earners, if I lose my job, that looks very, very different. So our economic outlook, if we start seeing a substantial trend increase in the unemployment rate, looks very different from the sort of picture that the RBA and, in fact, most private economists have, which is sort of this gentle, very long U recovery.
Just to add to that, Glenn, I mean, we did a couple of episodes on the UK. I mean, there's 6,000 Australian SMEs, you know, exporting to the UK, and they base themselves there. There is a Kylie effect. You know, people go to Britain before they go across the channel. And if you look at the UK compared to, you know, Germany, there's twice as many Australian firms in the UK. So I actually think whatever happens with Brexit, Australia will still do a lot with the UK. It's a question of overall confidence, as Joe says. But in terms of where SMEs go, in terms of where investment is, the UK is still very substantial.
Michelle, no implications in terms of financial stability with Brexit?
Well, the thing that worries me about just generally this whole geopolitical situation is that it's already been highlighted. It just increases uncertainty. It makes people unwilling to invest. We just muddle along. Interest rates remain really low, and we remain in this sort of stasis almost. It's sort of, we're not going anywhere. Mm. What we really want is more investment, more growth, more inflation, and that would be good for financial stability. A lot of people highlight the fact that it's sort of difficult for banks to make profits in very low interest rate environments, and that there's always a bit of a tension between competition and stability, but banks, profitable banks, are good for financial stability.
That's something obviously the RBA is very aware of in terms of the importance of, you know, having solid performing banks in terms of providing stability to the economy.
We want competition, but we also want the banks to be solid and resilient and stable, which they are.
Yep.
But in very low profit environments, as you can observe from some of the European banks, it's very challenging for them. And if they're undercapitalised and they're not resilient, they don't lend, and they don't lend, there's no investment, and, you know, it all builds on itself. So financial stability is key to making sure that the economy performs well.
Just even for your audience, I mean, it's quite difficult, right? We're three economists here and you're talking about political events, right? But the IMF has actually now released a geopolitical event risk index. Mm. So you can track that online, and it actually dates back to 1800, so it's quite fascinating. And it's a good way to get a sense of the ebb and flow of these tensions that are going on around the world, and then that it sort of allows you to put some framework around how you think about the sentiment impact and the flow through to the economy.
Fantastic. My final question, because I'm conscious we're running out of time, is about inflation. And I'm conscious, Michelle, you may not be able to answer, but I remember in the 70s, you know, inflation was through the roof, and even in the 80s, etc. But is inflation dead as a problem now? Or have those days well and truly behind us and we've moved to a different paradigm? Or will we see inflation back again?
I mean, in a sense, you should always be inquisitive about the story that no one's talking about it. So I was quite thrilled to hear Michelle talking about the risk to bond yields if inflation rears its ugly head. So I'd make two comments, right? So low inflation is not unique to Australia. We have seen a clear shift in the relationship between unemployment and wages. Now, there's still a relationship there, but it's taking a long time and a much, much tighter labour market to generate any wage growth. So if you look at the US, you know, quite late cycle and only just starting to really generate some wage growth. But that wage growth is not feeding through to inflation. So from a inflation targeting central bank perspective, you've got two concerns here. It's taking a long, long time to generate wage growth, and even when you do generate it, it's not feeding through. So that would be my first point. And there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes about why that may be so. And some of that's to do with the globalization of the labor market. If you take a bottom-up approach in Australia, you know, you can split our inflation basket into four categories, and three of the four of them are not going up, right? 25% is retail prices facing severe competition. 25% is housing-related, not going up. 25% is administered, so has some sort of government influence on it. Governments are working very hard to bring down the cost of living, starting to deflate. And all you get left with is domestic services, which are highly correlated to wage growth, which is very, very weak. So I think it's incredibly difficult to see a scenario where core inflation rises dramatically from here.
I think Joe's right. I mean, compared to the 70s where we had wage and profits out of kilter, so we had to have the accord and we had to have real wage restraint and get employment going, I think we've now got the opposite problem.
Yep.
Where the profit share of national income's too high and we actually have to get the more wages growth.
Yep.
And that's the best way, more so than just inflation.
Wonderful. Well, I think we're out of time, and I want to thank an incredible panel today, but three incredible speeches. So a quick round of applause to our three speakers today.
Thank you.